Right, hello. Welcome to episode 4 of the RepuChat podcast. I hope all you guys listening out there are well. I hope everything's going all right for you. Just want to start this episode out with a quick shout out to Brian Barczyk and all the guys and girls over at the Reptarium. Obviously, Brian's got a lot going on at the moment. If you guys aren't aware, I suggest going over to his channel and having a quick check of the last few videos. And if you guys are aware, and if you're able, please go and donate via the Legacy Aquarium donation GoFundMe thing. I will pop a link in the description at the end of the podcast. Obviously, can't imagine what he's going through, but I know myself and most people I've spoken to, Brian Barczyk's been a big part of our reptile journeys, whether it's from the beginning or all the way through. So yeah, lots of thoughts and prayers from all us UK guys going out to Brian and the whole Reptarium team. So, got an exciting guest today. Before we get to them, just a quick little bit about me and what's going on. So breeding season is well underway here. No royal eggs on the ground yet, but lots of ovulations and prelay sheds. So hopefully we'll have some eggs on the ground and in the incubator within the next few weeks. I also got a clutch of unexpected cresty eggs. So they are in a vermiculite tub just chilling at room temperature. Not something I've bred before, so it'll be exciting to see if they hatch. So yeah, that's exciting. If you want to keep up to date with me, my personal reptile stuff, please go check out my Instagram, which is at Ben's Balls. Again, link in the description. I mean, if you want to keep up to date with the podcast, future guests, Q&As, all that sort of stuff, that is at RepTochat on Instagram. So, today's guest, as you can probably tell by the title, is Marv from MJ's Pythons. I'm going to get him straight on because he's got a massive collection and, massive variety of a collection. I can't wait to dive into it. Without any further ado, let's get him in.
Aha!
Hello!
Welcome. Well,
thank you very much for joining me. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I am not too bad, thank you. It's been about 3 weeks since I've done a podcast, so I feel a little bit rusty. But yeah, I'm been looking forward to this one.
It's been a while since I was live anywhere or did a video or did it live anywhere, so rusty.
Oh, that's good. We're both a little bit rusty then. So I don't know if you've listened before or not, but I like to start the podcast off with a section called Get to Know. Basically, it's 10 like quick fire questions. Yes. Just sort of break the ice a little bit. We'll crack on with those and then we'll jump straight in. So if you're ready, we will go straight in with the Get to Know.
Yep.
Once I can find them. So first exotic pet.
Leopard gecko.
Rough number of current exotics kept, roughly.
450, 500.
Nice. Your favourite species in your collection?
Oh, that's a difficult one. That is a difficult one. Favourite species, I mean, it fluctuates constantly, but I think one that has always been top of my list in terms of just the animal itself, Burmese python.
Awesome. The most obscure animal in your collection?
Meerkats.
Nice. We'll cover those a bit later. And money/space/legalities, no object. One animal that you haven't got that you would love to have?
Raccoon.
Oh, cool. Yeah, good shout. I like that. Right, and then we move away from the animals quickly. There's five, like, not animal-related questions, and then we'll go straight into it. So, beach or mountains?
Mountains.
Sun or snow?
Sun.
Vacation or staycation?
Staycation.
Night in or night out?
Night in.
Early bird, night out, permanently exhausted pigeon?
Permanently exhausted pigeon. Absolutely. Yeah.
I think, honestly, most people are saying the same sort of thing. So I'm glad I'm not the only one. So that's the get to know you section. So if nothing else, broken the ice a little bit, and maybe some of the listeners get to know you a little bit more than they did previously.
Yes.
So jumping straight into the main topic, I guess. Tell the listeners a bit about you. When was your first exotic animal encounter? And then from that, when did you get into exotics as a whole?
So, first exotic encounter. To be honest, the hobby as a whole was a complete alien thing to me. I didn't even know it existed until a few years ago. So I think the first ever exotic that I actually directly interacted with that I can remember was a bloke holding, and I have no idea what snake it was, but it was in the mountains of Morocco. We were halfway up one of the Atlas Mountains, and this bloke was walking around with a snake, and that was the first time I ever sort of directly encountered in person an animal of the, well, an exotic anyway. I think fast forwarding my house life in terms of parents, particularly dad, was not massive fan of keeping animals. He has his own reasons, but he has very much been the guy who's always, well, he won't even go to the zoo because his viewpoint is they belong in the wild. So slowly but surely, I finally managed to sneak some fish into the house one day, and that was left alone. That slowly sort of crept into multiple aquariums. So I really started with fish. In terms of myself, I had quite a large collection of fish. I then moved out for a while and hatched two ducks, Donald and Daffy, who passed away a few
Good
years ago
names.
now.
Good
But
names.
they were actually named by primary school kids. They were Cool Thing One Thing Two when they hatched because I just went, let's have a go, let's try and hatch some eggs. And they had the numbers one and two written on their eggs when I put them in the incubator. This was a rudimentary incubator, by the way, and I was what, 15 at the time, maybe. They hatched out. They were then taken. I did a little show at school back then. Was my previous primary school, and the kids there called them Donald and Daffy. They lived to the ripe old age of 18, which is typically unheard of for ducks. But when I then moved back home, the boys came with me, and then from there I slowly started adding more things. The first thing I got were turtles because I had the aquariums already there. So my excuse was, well, the aquariums are there, the aquariums are there.
Well, they can go straight in. No extra housing needed.
Well, that was when I started hemorrhaging money because my room was tiny, but I've always been good with Tetris. So from very early on, I had custom enclosures built. I had the terrapin sort of, they were only tiny little things, but raising up in their own little mini tank. Then I got a custom one built for them to go in. Slowly, shortly after that, though, I ended up with a leopard gecko. And then there was the big thing, which I always wanted to have a snake. So it took a while to convince anyone to have a snake. But the story goes, same time, sort of time that I really was trying to push to get a snake, my sister wanted to get a cat. Both parents were against both things, but I just went, well, if she's getting a cat, I'm getting a snake, and didn't wait for the end result and just went out and got a snake. First pair of snakes, garter snakes. No one knew they were in the house apart from my mom at the time. And the reason I went for garters because they were fish eaters. And my mom didn't like the idea of having rodents in the house. First night, I had built them a little temporary sort of holding enclosure type thing. That's when I learned that snakes are escape artists, and both escaped on the first night I brought them home and ended up inside the drywall. I thought, oh my God, they're gone forever. Sure enough, they appeared. I managed to lure them out eventually after over the course of a week, whilst we were all dreading that these things would just appear one day in the middle of the house while my dad was
Yeah, while you're
just
sat
there.
having dinner, they just appear.
Yeah, exactly. So we eventually found them. I had them for a number of years. I had they only passed away recently, sort of oops, last sort of year or two. And then shortly after that, I decided I wanted another snake. I had convinced, I could look after snakes. And I ended up grabbing myself a royal python who lived in a tiny little, well, it wasn't tiny, but it was a, I had like, those shelving racks you get from B&Q, the sort of heavy duty shelves.
Like
So
the
I had
metal ones
some.
that sort of they look like Meccano almost.
Yeah, so I got one of them, but I did them all up so that you couldn't see any of the metal. So I hid the sides, I had plants over the front, etc. And that's where I had all my aquariums. And at the very bottom, I had like a space just enough for those Exoterra. I don't know what you call them. I know they have a name. They're sort of like flat, not very deep, with the meshed top.
Like the plastic ones.
Yeah, one of those plastic.
They're Fornariums, I think they're called.
I think those ones. And it was that gap at the bottom was just enough to fit this thing in. So I cut a piece of sort of hardboard, painted it black, so it looked like there was nothing down there, just to hide it from everyone. And it sort of stayed like that for a good while until I started sort of working at a pet shop, met Jay, etc. And then that became something a lot bigger. At that time, I then had the, what did I have at the time? So then reptiles were in the house, it was fine. So I had the leopard gecko, I had the ball python, I rescued a ridgetail monitor, ended up being gifted a second ball python, the blue, black-eyed leucistic. I still had all my aquariums. I then shut down my main aquarium and replaced that with an equally sized, the sort of 3 foot by 3 foot by foot and a half exoceras, the largest size they make. Yeah. That was my first planted aquarium, planted vivarium. I did my research, watched a load of videos, which is what we all do.
Yeah.
Put it together, and that was my chameleon. So that's where I was at that time. And then I moved out and got this place with Jay, and just there was no one to say no anymore.
Yeah. And
it just snowballed from there, really.
Yeah, that's incredible, to be honest. What a sort of jump from going from one small little animal to where you are now. And roughly how many years are we talking was that? The times, man. When did you go from like from the first animal to the first like a proper exotic, not the fish, let's say first reptile, to where you are now roughly?
Probably 10 years.
Really, it's quite a quick expansion, really. And 10 years isn't much in the long run, but I suppose it goes, once you're into a space like you are now, space isn't really, well, it probably is now, but when you first go in there, space isn't much of an issue.
It was a blank canvas to be filled. That's how we looked at this place.
Yeah. And I'll bet you, is it filled completely now, or is there room for...
I have said I cannot squeeze anything more in here, even if I tried. And then I amazed myself at the vast quantity of space I still managed to find. I was at max capacity long before we got into the frogs. And now we've got 7, 8, 9, 12, 13 vivs with frogs. And we are looking at expanding again in terms of the frog stuff.
Awesome.
So to be honest, it's lucky it's just me and Jay here. So every nook, and the dogs, but every nook and cranny we can fit stuff in. My thing is, I have never liked, my OCD will not allow things to be disorganized or just random vivs stacked on top of each other. So whenever we build something, wherever we start a project like this, it has to sort of blend with the house. It can't just be there and as an eyesore or just this big bulk of something.
It has to sort of fit in as furniture, or it's supposed to look like it's there, not just being plonked there.
Precisely. So for example, the latest frog viv, we noticed, so we started with our first little tower, which fit into a nice little alcove by the in the living room. And then we noticed in the living room, there's a radiator, but you also got the doors to the kitchen. And there was just over a foot of like wall at the end. So you had the radiator against the wall, a foot of space, and then the kitchen door. And we're like, you know what? We could fit exoterras in there.
Yep.
So we used up that entire wall, turned off the radiator, used up that entire wall, making it flush with the door of the kitchen, and then made it a sort of TV countertop area with a cover.
Yeah.
And that's one of our displays at the moment.
Yeah, that's so cool. That's awesome. So we're going to touch on royals, but I don't really want to do loads of royals today because everyone talks about royals all the time. So we will touch on them quickly, obviously, because you have got quite a few of them in the back behind us. What are your most anticipated plans, breeding plans for the year that you're excited about, that you want to share?
Quite honestly, this year, not much. And the reason I say not much is due to multiple reasons, but also because of the current market.
Yeah,
I decided to take a year basically off royals. I have started pairing again recently, but it has been very recently. So if they go,
I presume that's a few selected pairings as opposed to the normal amount.
I've got a potential of about 40 breeder females, which I could breed if I wanted to. I think behind me, we've got tags on about 7, and I'm not pushing any in particular. It was just, so this year we are working predominantly on stuff where, one of those instances where regardless of what hatches out of that clutch, we're keeping everything.
Okay.
So I sort of kept it to right project wise. Let's look at clutches where realistically, unless obviously we get screwed with the sexes, it would be something regardless of what comes out, we are looking to keep, rather than the clutches where you're trying to hit one particular outcome. Just to keep it lighter this year, I suppose, gives the girls a break. I know there's been, for some reason, a shortage of rodents out there at the moment.
Yeah, it does seem that way at the moment.
I couldn't get hold of rodents for love nor money. Obviously, we do have the rat shed. That has been temporarily shut down just because of events. But yeah, I shut down the rat shed over winter and got basically culled off all the rodents just before time, for the fact that it wasn't really particularly going well at that point anyways, and I couldn't get any rodents in, so I just decided, you know what, we've restarted it up again as of last weekend. We've repopulated some of the tubs with new rodents.
Yeah, to be honest, sometimes it's good to sort of start almost from scratch again, I imagine. It's not something I've done yet, but I would like to get into the rodent game at some point. Not necessarily to produce all of the food that I need, but it's quite handy. Like say, if it gets to the point where I can't get hold of any, that I know I've got a backup.
Well, we had fluctuations. We were going through periods where we were producing more rodents than we could feed off physically.
Yeah.
To periods of producing no rodents at all. And I tried different. They were eating like kings. They had every, you know, fresh fruit, vegetable, and about seven different types of muesli, dry foods we were feeding them, etc. I think the key point that I missed was the turnover rate for the adult cobrida colonies. So I've spoken to a few people who've been doing this for a while and have had, you know, consistent success rather than the ups and downs, as well as people who have had similar experiences to me where it goes really up, you know, you're producing loads of rodents and then it suddenly crashes again.
Yeah.
And I think the one thing we weren't doing quite as well, quite like the ones who've got that permanent success, is replacing the breeders. So we are now moving to sort of a plan of every 4 months from their first litter replacing the breeding stock. Yeah. And we're going to see how that goes, basically.
Okay, it'll be interesting to know how it goes. I'll definitely if I get the go ahead from my wife than anything else, I'll be sure to send you a message later on in the year.
Yeah, we had the ability to just a couple of years ago, we built a 10-by-8-foot shed just for the rodents, and it's been handy to have, and to be honest, it's probably covered the majority of our feeding on and off. The only problem is it was getting to a stage where we're having to spend, you know, roughly about £300 on, you know, £300 a month roughly, on sort of bedding and food for the rodents, and then double that again on frozen because we weren't producing enough rodents to feed. So it was
very frustrating, if nothing else.
Yeah, it was. You know, we're hemorrhaging money on these rodents and not really getting anything out of them. So we need to reassess and see, you know, what are we doing wrong? Because 9 times out of 10, it's us doing something wrong.
Sometimes, like I said, you need to take a step back and go, "Oh right, okay."
Yeah.
So no, that's good. I'm glad you got it started back up again. Hopefully, you'll have a bit more success than you were last time. But
yeah, hopefully, we'll have that consistent success this year. And I mean, in all honesty, this is like, I really want it to work out because there are a lot of animals that need feeding and I always prefer my own rodents. I know what.
Yeah, definitely. If you know exactly what's going into them from birth, then you'll be a happier feeding them off.
But if it doesn't work out, if 12 months from now we're still, you know, ups and downs, lefts and rights, then it will probably be a case of just permanently discontinuing breeding rodents. Yeah. Just settle with the right, we'll buy our rodents in. And then there's an 10-by-8-foot shed, which, you know,
you can run fill with freezers.
Well, run wild with. I mean, we were already coming up with a list of animals we were going to populate in there. And then I went, no, let's get rodents again before we start the other bison
magnet. Oh, fair play. Right. So we'll touch on roars. Let's move away from those because everyone knows what's going on with roars. I want to start with frogs, if that's all right. So I'm going to say I'm a frog virgin. What's my frog experience? I held a white tree frog once and that was it. So what have you got? Let's start with that. What are you keeping to start with?
Okay, so currently we have all dart frogs, different species. So we have, and I'm going to make mistakes here, Philobates terribilis. We've got Dendrobates tinctorus azurus, the Leucomeles, which are the bumblebees. We've recently got the Aratus, or the high, is it high blues? High blue Aratus. I think they're the four species off the top of my head that we're working with at the moment.
Okay, and what sort of numbers are we talking as a whole?
Well, we have had success in breeding one of them. So most of them, so for example, the Terribilis, we've got a pair, or we thought were a pair. It's kind of looking like it's two females because we've had them a year now and no one's calling yet. Yep. So we're probably going to be on a hunt for a male. So we've got two of them. The blue guys, the Azurus, we have a pair plus a young little pair. And then I've got about five at school, which are in an enclosure there. Bumblebees, we had a pair last year. We were successful in breeding them. I think from one pair, we produced about 57-ish.
Oh, okay. Is that a good amount? I don't really know what sort of clutch sizes they...
I think averages from people I spoke to is probably somewhere around 20 or 30. I think the reason we did quite well was, again, it's a learning curve. We're brand new to frogs, really. Yeah. But the misting system and the amount you spray them, etc., has a big impact on how they breed. I think basically we didn't give them the cue to stop until we sort of found out that actually you need to stop spraying them to stop them breeding.
Okay, so you almost have to cycle the seasons for them to know what's going on a bit.
Because we noticed our male was getting quite thin.
Yeah.
Although he was eating, he seemed quite thin, and we were a bit concerned, reached out to a few people, and like, yep, he's being overbred, basically. So we reassessed the spraying system. We basically shut it down, started doing it where, not manually, because they're all connected to Alexa, but instead of having it just on a timer, per se, manually having to actually turn the thing on and spray them once every 2 days rather than twice a day. And he's recovered now. We since have added another three pairs of bumblebees, of adult bumblebees, and then the Aratus, the high blue Aratus. We just got a group of seven in recently, a few weeks ago. It's the plan with them is, that's what we have at the moment. The plan is we built a unit that encompasses seven vivaria.
So is this the one on your Instagram that's got the branch that goes through all? So yeah, if you haven't seen it, go and check out MJ's Instagram. It's incredible. I'll let you explain it, but it's so cool.
I'll show it in a moment. I will go down there. I only came in here temporarily for this podcast because it's quiet for now.
Yeah.
Until the dogs eventually realize I'm up here, and then
honestly, my dogs are being saints at the moment. I'm amazed they're never this quiet.
Well, there's a cat flap in this door, and soon enough, Bella's going to shove her head through it. We did take them out for a walk earlier to try and wear them out a little bit. But I will show it off in a moment. It's seven vivaria in a row. We wanted it to look like one big one. So what we did is we went to local woods, spent about an hour searching the woods for different candidates for branches, brought a few home, played around with them, what they would look like, eventually found one we liked. So we chopped it up into seven pieces and arranged it within the seven to make it look like a fallen branch going through all seven. So it ties them all together. It doesn't look as tied anymore because the plants are really starting to take off in there now. So you can still kind of see they're connected, especially to the back end. But that was the vision. And the vision was each of the seven, we would have a different species of dart frog and a different species of day gecko, of miniature or dwarfed day geckos.
So, staying with the frogs for now, obviously you're keeping, what are you keeping them in? I can't word myself. So I was wanting to get into dart frogs myself. With the species that you've got, what would you recommend to start with species wise and then like a basic setup? I've got a couple of Exoterras of different sizes knocking about here. Would I go fully planted bioactive? What lighting am I using? Do they need heat?
So frogs, in terms of to keep, the best typically are, well, you've got a few. Three of the ones we have are typically beginning snakes. You've got Terribilis, which are the largest of the dart frogs. They are very, very bold and boisterous. They're sort of run right up to the front when you feed, etc. You've got the Azurus, which are the sort of typical blue-black dart frog. They're quite confident as well. They do well. And then you've got the bumblebees, which are leucomelus. They're a little bit more nervous, so they're not as bold and not out as much. They do get used to you, though. I mean, ours are more out more and more every day. And they know when I'm shaking fly pots. They'll all come running to the front. I would say, so you can go about it a couple of different ways. I think really, as far as dart frogs go, a planted vivarium is just a must. It helps you so much with, in terms of shelter, in terms of keeping the humidity up. If your plants are happy, the frogs are happy. There is a saying that frogs like wet backs but dry feet, which is to say they do not like standing in wet dampness all the time because they can get sort of foot fungus, etc. However, they do like it really humid. So the plants really help with that. Typical sort of vivarium size, I reckon your standard sort of 45 cubes are really, really good for a pair. You then need to consider as well what kind of community you want. So Azurus don't like being kept, or females fight quite prolifically. I mean, they'll fight constantly. They wrestle, and it's just not recommended. So they're typically pairs only. Whereas the bumblebees and the terribilis, they are communal, so you can keep a large group of them. And obviously, if you're going to keep a large group, the vivarium size come into account. We went with a 3 foot for our, so 3 foot, 3 foot Exoterra for our terribilis. A, because they're a larger dart frog, and B, we had intentions to let them sort of breed and then add from their stock back in there, so we build a nice little group in there. We do, however, have our sort of breeding pairs, if you will, apart from the Terribilis, which are too big anyways. But the other breeding groups, we have them in the 30 by 30 by 60 tall Exoterra. They'll be fine in a 45. We went with a 60 because we've got the arboreal geckos and the frogs on the bottom. It just create more separation. Lighting, we tend to just go for quite strong but cheap LED lighting. So Exoterra do these sort of screw-in bulbs that come from an LED bar. There are cheaper alternatives. Are basically made in the same factory. They work great. Any LED light essentially is really good. And the reason you want LED is frogs don't like heat. Their biggest enemy is the heat. They can survive really cool temperatures. They cannot survive warm temperatures for long, which is why we have all our frogs downstairs, because up here just gets to way too warm with all the vivs and all the heat mats. It's like entering a different climate up here. So they have no heating whatsoever on them. They do have tiny little spider mats, but that's for the geckos. It will not impact the frogs at all. So they've got just on the sides of the vivs, you've just got those tiny little heat mats stuck in. That gives the geckos somewhere to sort of lean on and hug some heat if they want to. We see them do it every now and again. So because I've seen them utilize it, I keep it in there. So really, room temperature is key. It is sort of perfectly ideal for the dart frogs. The summer we were, a little bit worried because of that heat we had last year. But I just, we've got big, the bottles that are used for water dispensers. Again, what you've got
Yeah,
those.
big, like there's 25 liters or something like that.
Yeah, and they've got that sort of neck at the top. That's what we use as our reservoirs for the spraying system. And what we did in the summer is I just got a load of ice cubes essentially and just filled it with ice cubes. So when the sprayer did come on, it was cold water and
Yeah,
it
and it
brought the
brought
temperature
the whole temperature down.
down. Obviously, the ice cubes melt pretty quick, but where they're in cupboards away from the heat, they're sort of, it's the part of the house that doesn't really get too warm at all. They did fine this summer. So summertime, you want to make sure they're in a cool place. You don't want them near a window, especially a window that the sun beats on all day. Very inexpensive to keep once you get it all set up.
No, it sounds really good. And I was going to do the geckos as like a separate segment, but as I didn't realize you were keeping them together. So how do you, what species of geckos are you keeping with the frogs, and how do you find they get on? Are they absolutely fine? No issues at all?
Okay,
How long have they been in there, that sort of thing?
different people will have different opinions. I started keeping them together because the person who got me into dart frogs did it for years with great success, and so do many people. I have had zero issues. I've had them together now coming on. I think we've had the frogs now about 18 months, had them together since the start, never had an issue. So we keep a lot of the Felsuma species. So Felsuma Lunyata, Felsuma, who else is there? So they've got, the Lion Dageckos, we've got the Gold Dust Dageckos, we have Clamorite inbound. There's one group that've also got oh my goodness. The chameleon geckos, are what they're called. Boas chameleon geckos, which are actually a New Caledonian species.
Yeah.
They're dwarf little tiny things. They're in there as a placeholder at the moment because that viv those vivs are empty. They won't be there permanently, but again, they've been completely fine with the frogs. The we also have William's Eye, which were a nightmare to get hold of because of all the legislation now and the price that these things go for, which are the sort of neon blue day geckos, if you will.
Yeah.
More skittish, again, fine. These we're not talking about of the giant Madagascan day gecko. I
Yeah,
would
no, we're
treat
talking
them
like
as
small, like almost like mourning gecko size.
exactly. They're a little, some of them are a little bit bigger than a mourning gecko. There are only a pair per viv. Most of these geckos anyway only live in pairs. They will not, for example, Clemorite, you can keep them in a massive colony, but only the most dominant male and female will breed. So they're great for displays in that case if you want to keep breeding down. But if you want to breed them, they're best off in pairs. So we ideally, well, small Dageckos, we've had success with Olenieta in breeding them. Goldust are only just about coming up to size. Clemorites, as I said, are unbound. Our Williams, I did lay a couple of infertiles right at the end of last season. So we're hoping once they get going again this season, they'll start dropping some eggs for us. The geckos seldom leave the top third of the viv. Very, very rarely do you see them any lower than the very, very top. And obviously, dart frogs don't venture up there. Ours do because for some reason, ours love to climb. I have no idea why.
There's always a way. There's
Our frogs
always.
also eat. They also eat Pangaea, which is unheard of. I think it when they were younger, we had them together, and the Pangaea pots, which are the it's like a little paste that you make,
I've got
fruit
crusties
and
on.
paste. So when we feed them the fruit flies, some of the fruit flies will go in there, lay eggs, and then the Pangaea is then embedded with maggots, which is really good for frogs. Maggots are high nutrition. I think when we used to do that, they got a taste for Pangaea. So they actually seek out Pangaea raw without any maggots, and they literally sit up there eating it. Completely
Do
natural.
you find the geckos come down for the fruit flies at all, or they're it's just
If they're really hungry, then yes. But very rarely are they that hungry because they've always got Pangaea available. But they will basically pick off any of the flies that come up into their territory. So as soon as the flies start climbing the glass up to their level, they start picking off everything up there.
That works quite well then, doesn't it? Because I've got my crusties. Occasionally, we get quite a lot of like the fungus gnats or the fruit fly sort of, and having a like the smaller geckos in there, that would be ideal to eat them. Obviously, I'm not suggesting I put them in with my crusties, but that would be a small gecko
Yeah,
like that would be ideal to take off the little flies.
they work wonders because unfortunately the way ExoTerra is designed, the one weak spot in terms of fly escaping is the top. They just always find a way out. So the geckos keep the well, they reduce the number of flies that actually get out of the enclosures, which is really good for us because we don't have flies. I mean, in here right now it's pretty good. This is the royal room; it's the warmest room and the most humid room of the house. But this is also where we breed our fruit flies. So God forbid there are times in here where it's honestly you should be slapping
You walk in
myself
like a
cold.
swarm.
They don't fly, but they do attract the wild fruit flies because of the smell of the culture media. And so you get just wild fruit flies just waiting the whole time they're waiting. And you come in and they think, oh, look, something to suck on. And it's just horrific. But flies aside, they honestly are a play. And I think the reason we got into the frogs and the geckos the way we did is setting up the naturalistic enclosures, setting up the bioactive stuff is honestly a passion. And there's nothing better than looking at a really nicely done vivarium after maybe a year of it growing in and you know it's really matured and everything's sort of done its
Yeah,
thing.
no, I completely agree. I quite often, my daughter and I quite often have a conversation that one of our favorite parts of keeping the reptiles is setting up the enclosures. Like, I absolutely love it. So behind me, this one is a chameleon enclosure. Unfortunately, all the plants in there are plastic because I tried and tried and tried with live plants, and he just kept destroying them. So he's got plastic ones, but he's never tried to eat them or anything. So that works really well. And then I've got two ExoTerras, one like tall one and one long wide one. One with Crestes in and one with a leopard gecko in. Both of those have got like foam backgrounds, live planters. But the Crestes one, I'm not having much luck with at the moment. Everything keeps dying. So I'm still working on that one. It's enjoyable.
Because gecko-wise, we, apart from the day geckos, we also keep, we've been working quite strongly with the New Caledonian stuff. Apart from Crestes, we have a pair of gargoyles, we have a pair of mossies, we have a singular Lichianus at the moment because we're working out what sex it is before we get the counterpart.
Yeah.
And realistically, they just don't treat their plant. I mean, they don't like it as wet, first of all. So sometimes the plants suffer because of that. They're also nocturnal, so you don't really want to put them under beaming bright lights. So we're still experimenting with how to get it perfectly bioactive, but also keep them happy.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, for other reasons, like you said with your chameleon, our chameleon also has, he's got one life plant in there, but yeah, it's all fake because my previous chameleon would just devour every plant you put in there. The peach throat monitor has completely decimated every square inch of her vivarium. I should have known better. I should have known better when I built it that foam and bark would not stand up to her claws and her levels of activity.
But I bet it looked amazing before you put her in there. I bet you were all happy with it.
I know I put that one up online and, well, on Instagram somewhere. And that is, in terms of the vibs, I can fit in there. It's a 5 foot by 4.5 foot by 3 foot.
No.
I don't know how to turn cameras. Not on this platform anyway, but it's right behind me. She lives in the royal room. So this is the viv behind me. She has completely decimated every part of it. So we found a tree, a fake tree, and we've just rammed it in there.
It works.
She's loving that. It was all bromeliads and all sorts of plants planted in here. She has a spraying system, etc. She's in there somewhere. But if I stand up, oh, good Lord. So you've also got, we did the green tree pythons. They're obviously a dream for us.
Yeah.
But they are now a mixture between live and plastic. IKEA is remarkably good for plastic plants.
It is, I have to agree.
In terms of like these little fake ones, they look so great. They honestly do look naturalistic. We sometimes get plants that they try to make look naturalistic, but don't when you mix them with the live stuff.
Yeah.
These have blended in really well. But they have a waterfall system in there as well, which was something I was really into back then, the waterfalls.
Yeah.
And I had waterfalls everywhere. And now I've sort of decided against the waterfalls. Apart from the green trees, which actually works really well.
Yeah.
The waterfalls just ended up becoming a little bit of an annoyance because of the way we built them. But even behind me here, we have the Bradley's python, which is obviously Bradley's. But again, she's fully planted as well.
Yeah.
A lot of the plants in hers came from sort of offcuts downstairs.
Okay.
Oh, good Lord. Let me just place that back. There we go. So yeah, there's the live plant stuff is really cool. And it makes life a lot easier when it's all automated. The more automated you make it, the more you enjoy it. The only time I ever go in to those enclosures to do anything is either to trim the plants because they've completely overgrown and are consuming the entirety of the viv, or to clean glass.
Yeah.
Other than that, or feeding, obviously. Other than that, you know, bioactive in terms of waste, etc. The stuff in there just breaks it all down. Even when it comes to the green trees, the springtails and wood lice and earthworms in there, you might notice the poop tonight and by tomorrow morning it's completely vanished.
Yeah, so, no, I find the same thing. Even with my leopard gecko, he's got an arid viv, but it's still like bioactive as best it can be. He has a tendency to eat the woodlice for some reason. Regardless of how big much I feed him, he will eat forever. But yeah, like even that, like the poo, it just disappears instantly. But he's a good lad. He's big actually. He's in a 3 foot by, what is it? Is it 90 wide, 45 exoterra?
Oh, yeah,
that's fully planted. But he's old now. He's like 19. So I think dark frogs will eventually end up where he is at the moment.
Yeah, it's, we all know royals are addictive. And they will, I think they always will be.
Yeah.
Frogs are even more so. They cost less in some cases.
Yeah.
I will tell you, there is nothing better than sitting downstairs in the evening, having dinner or just relaxing, watching TV. And then the orchestra begins and all the singing starts. And you've got all the singing of all the different species. And I can't wait to have seven different species with seven different calls.
Yeah.
The nice thing is as well, they are diurnal. So they're awake when you're awake.
Yeah.
And they don't have an obnoxious loud call. The American white tree frogs, which are now at school, are nocturnal. And Lord, when they go off at night.
I have I've heard white tree frogs. They are loud. I wouldn't want those in my house, to be honest.
No, they are extremely loud. Whereas the dart frogs... some species, unless you're right up against the viv, you ain't going to hear them. They sound more like an electrical buzz than they do an actual call.
Oh, okay.
But then things like the bumblebees, it's audible. You would hear it upstairs, but it wouldn't be blaring. It would be, and it's a soft, gentle, quite...
like when you can hear the birds singing in the morning when you wake up.
Yeah, it's a really appealing sound. It's a really soothing sound as well. And when you've got them sort of calling from multiple directions, it does... I find it personally very relaxing because it's not that loud, piercing, almost barking that some frogs make. It is more like a sweet song. So it makes it sort of between crickets calling and a bit more melody.
Okay. That's cool. Yeah, I definitely want to add some. I've looked into frogs multiple times and I've never bit the bullet. But I think once the leopard gecko finally passes away, not that I want him to go, but It's inevitable at some point. That viv would be ideal for something. Maybe I don't know what species yet, but something I've definitely looked at a few times.
A 90x45x45 is a perfect size enclosure. I mean, there's so much you can do. The thing is with the dart frogs and the planted vivarium in general, the bigger you go, the easier everything becomes. I mean, it's more work setting it up, etc. But there's nothing harder than trying to plant a tiny little cube because where do you fit? How do you fit? Tweezers are coming out. I'm trying to find miniature plants to fit in areas.
Yeah, it's like aquascaping.
Yeah, oh God, don't turn me back to this. I'm planting a 3-foot carpet of baby tears with literally eyebrow tweezers. It took me, I really don't want to think about how many hours I spent of my life literally planting these things with tweezers. But yeah, I mean, I'm actually looking at the Brevdies one, which is the size you're describing, and you know, it's a fantastic size viv at some point for, you know, I would probably say that's the perfect size viv for maybe a communal species.
So that's why I quite like. Not, I don't want a lot, but maybe like 3 or 4. I don't know. It depends on how the ratios work with the sexes and that sort of stuff. But something to get to in the future.
Yeah, it's definitely something you can, and there are so many species out there to work with. There's a lot of, I mean, most of the dendrobates. I mean, Tinctorus, the blue one, there's over 100 different sort of color variations.
Yeah.
And I think one really interesting thing about the frogs, which is in complete contrast to the royals, is that with the frogs, the community, and quite rightly so, are very anti-mixing, if you will, morphs. Because the morphs that exist literally are ones found in the wild. And sometimes they're found in honestly tiny, tiny regions. I mean, very rarely is it bigger than a kilometer square. Normally we're talking maybe a couple hundred meters squared. And that's the only place in the world you'd find that particular variation of that frog. So they're very strict or very keen to not have crossbreeding occur. Because they're not, the morphs you see for dart frogs aren't human made, they're not man made.
Yeah, you could go and pick them straight out of the wild.
Exactly. They are, their names, etc., represent a specific locality where they've come from. And I really do like that. As opposed to royals, I like picking the sort of the animals which most interest me in whatever way, you know, whether they come with pattern or calls. And I know with royals, you tend to go, right, let's breed to make new patterns. With these, when I find myself looking at what dart frogs to get next, it's obviously looks is a major part, but I also think about behavior. Are they social? Are they not? Yeah. What kind of parents they are. Ufaga, for example, are brilliant, beautiful frogs, but they're one of the hardest to breed because Ufaga literally means egg eater. So they feed their tadpoles infertile eggs. So unlike the other ones, which we just remove the eggs from the enclosure, we have them in petri dishes. set them aside when they hatch, you put them there in little cups, and then start feeding them from there. That yep. couldn't work with that species. And then I spent a lot of my life on YouTube listening to calls of different dart frogs.
Well, just to see, just how you go, oh, when I'm sat on the sofa, do I want to listen to this one or that one?
Nothing worse than finding an exquisite looking frog with a terrible call. Just beautiful, stunning animal, and then it just, it's either silent or it sounds like a buzz, or it's like, what is that sound that it's producing?
Yeah.
But it's definitely a fun new sort of project we've been working on, and I mean, we're loving every minute of it.
Yeah, no, it sounds like you've got a real passion for that at the moment as well. That's it's awesome. They sound really interesting, to be honest. Like I said, it's something I've definitely looked into a few times, and I think once I've got the an empty vivarium, it'll definitely be something that becomes more of a reality. So we mentioned it briefly at the start of the podcast, but I want to move on to the meerkats, if you don't mind. Obviously, this is something that I don't think I've ever seen a meerkat in a pet shop. I don't know anybody apart from yourselves that has a meerkat, and I wouldn't even know where to start. So how did you get into meerkats?
First thing I'll put out there is, if anyone's listening, meerkats are cute and they can be cuddly. Ours are not particularly cuddly. What I will say is meerkats are not suited to normal domestication, the way we keep, you know, snakes, etc. So they came to us, to be honest, it started off as a bit of a joke, and then it sort of became a reality where someone had offered them to me. And I was like, yeah, of course I want meerkats. Just because, well, I mean...
Everybody wants meerkats, don't they?
Say no. And then, you know, at the time, this was a year prior, it seemed kind of like a joke.
Yeah.
And then one day I get the message going, do you still want them? Because I need them, you know, they need to be gone. I thought, oh, dear God, here we go. All right. So we went and picked them up. This was actually, do you remember when we had that fuel crisis?
Yes.
So we were stuck out in the middle of nowhere trying to find fuel to get these meerkats. So it was very quick. It happened very, very quickly, very, very suddenly. To the point where we didn't really have an enclosure prepped. I mean, it wasn't something that I was thinking that was going to happen anytime soon, or, you know, I wouldn't have gone out of my way to go collect these meerkats.
Yeah.
However, me personally, I don't regret it. They live under the stairs. So we converted. So we had a cupboard, quite a large cupboard under the entire staircase.
Yep.
So we do what we do best, which is destroy and then rebuild. So we completely tore the door off that, rebuilt a new door with mesh, filled it to about 2.5-3 foot deep with sort of loamy soil, sand, soil, clay kind of thing.
Yep.
And so there they came, and they were very, very shy creatures at first. You would even, ourselves, we would catch glimpses of them every now and again.
Okay.
They have, however, come out of their shells now. I mean, they're completely night and day too when we first got them.
Just to interrupt you for a second. Is it a pair or?
So we have Janice and Mick. They're actually two girls.
Right.
So that was the reason we ended up getting them in the beginning. The previous owner was hoping for a pair, didn't end up being a pair, had other priorities at the time. So we were like, yeah, we look after the girls. Yeah. So the girl, they're amazing. They're not scared of anything except for people. From day one, they were ready to fight the dogs. and they're just fearless. When it comes to the dogs, when it comes to anything else, they're absolutely fearless. They eat everything. And when I say everything, I literally mean everything. Anything and everything they will put in their mouth and they will eat.
Yeah.
Except for, there's only one thing, which is dog food. Anything marketed for dogs, they haven't the slightest of interest in. But we feed them, so we will feed them sort of cat food, both dry and wet.
Yeah.
Peppers, they love a good bell pepper. Fruits, vegetables, fish. Literally, their diet is more varied than mine. I'm working on it. But they're certainly more varied than mine. But the sand is also a really nice enrichment for them, because we will just buy, you know, 10 boxes of Moria worms, for example, and just throw them in the sand. They immediately disappear, and they give Ziglin that activity to dig for food. They were very shy, like I said, at first. Now, a big, very different story. We'll just open their pen up, and they will roam the kitchen. I put up a video recently of her sort of asking off, trying to sort of get food and scratching my leg, trying to get to it. But I will literally be cooking in the kitchen and they will be at the backs of my legs, just pouring the backs of my legs, asking for them. And I'll sort of just, you know, just hand them little bits of, you know, raw chicken here and there. Whatever I'm sort of cooking with, chop a piece off and there they go. They have got out a few times, actually.
They are out the house or out the pen?
Well, out of their pen. They are ridiculously intelligent. They have found a way to bypass the locking mechanism I have for the door and open it whilst I'm at work. And therefore, they have been out all day with the three dogs and the cat, because you know this, because there are little footprints all over the downstairs. So they have been out and about with the dogs all day. And to be honest, that terrified me. I mean, they have a baby cam for that exact reason. But they get on great. I think the dogs, a little bit nervous of them. They do have a tendency of nipping the back of their ankles. But they obviously, they're not pick up cuddly. Meerkats can be. You see meerkats on Instagram all the time, and you might see someone sort of, maybe we do more because I post about meerkats, I get more of it shown to me. But you know, I've got people like, you know, cuddling meerkats and in bed with meerkat and whatever. They're not that. They're just about getting to the point where they'll let us stroke them if they're feeding. So if they're feeding, I can sit there and just give them proper stroke and they won't sort of bolt and run away. We did successfully manage to give them a bath because one of them had a little bit of poop stuck to her back fur. So it had to happen. So I do have pictures of them sort of all like curled up in the towel staring at me. That wasn't easy.
It's hard enough giving my dogs a bath, let alone a meerkat.
See, the dogs are great. You know, they'll just stand there and let you bathe them. These had to be bathed in a sort of a cage. I hated it because I really didn't. I was scared that by doing it, I would destroy the bond we've built and they would be nervous again, etc. Because I'm literally hosing them down as they're in a cage in the bath. And, you know, then it's the drying off thing. We're trying to dry them off in towels. And obviously the poor things are terrified. So,
yeah.
You've ever seen the teeth on a meerkat? You don't want to be bitten by them. You really, really, really don't want to be bitten by a meerkat. She tried me once. It wasn't bad. Well, she didn't really try and like properly bite down. She was more of like a warning nip.
Yeah.
But they soon realized, I think they got used to the fact that we weren't trying to hurt them and they were fine. In contrast to a few nights later, where we were getting them ready to go to the show at the school, and they decided to hide under the radiator, so we had to try and fish them out. And obviously, now we're now poking them and prodding them with sticks because they're literally underneath the radiator.
Yeah.
Jay thought it would be a good time to pick them up and put them in a cage. That was met with a solid bite straight through the thumb.
Nice.
They will get there, and they are making progress. I mean, we'll take them out to the garden in the summer. They'll, you know, run around in the garden. The supervisor, of course, will be out there with them, but they'll run around in the garden. And they always return to their, like, cat box. Home. They literally have a cat box, which in the year, what I do is, you know how cat boxes, the top comes off the bottom?
Yeah.
So we have the bottom part of a cat box flipped upside down in their pen as a den. So that's then buried under the sand, and they dig into it, and they make that their den. So when we need to move them, say in the summer we want to put them outside, I re-put the cat box back together. And because that base has got all their scent in it, they will always dart back to that box. So anything spooks them, anything like that, they just go straight back to that box, which is really good. But I will show them off in a little bit because the noises they make are unlike anything I've ever heard.
So something there's a couple of questions I have about meerkats, actually. So do you need a license at all? What do they cut? Is it just like, in theory, going to buy a cat or a dog, but obviously the care is different?
Unfortunately, and I will say unfortunately, no, there is no licensing to keeping them. And the reason I say unfortunately is it wasn't until I got meerkats that I looked for meerkats for sale. And it's alarming how easy it is to buy a meerkat from a pet
shop. Yeah, I actually did the same thing last night. I was doing some research and having a look like for your, and I ended up on Facebook and I found a page where I could buy meerkats, I could buy foxes, I could buy owls, and like none of it's what's the word? I don't know what the word is. Like
regulated.
Yeah, that's the word I was looking for. Thank you. Like at all. So I could go out and just go and buy a fox. I was like, that's ridiculous.
The reason I say unfortunately and only licensing is, don't get me wrong, I mean, I love working with them and they are a constant joy. However, they became popular as pets because of the Compare the Meerkat advert. Everyone was like, oh, meerkats, let's get that. It became a novelty. They're not house pets ever for any reason. Yeah, people keep them indoors, but first of all, they're mob animals. They need to be in, you know, groups of their own. If they're not, they need your constant attention. Even when you watch Janice and Mavis interact with each other, they'll interact with you, and they are constantly reconnecting. They're constantly rubbing themselves on each other.
Yeah, that's the other thing I was going to ask you. As you've only got two, where I've seen meerkats in zoos a couple of times, and obviously they're in quite large groups, so they normally have one on sentry duty. How does it work with just the two of them? Because I can't imagine one of them's on sentry all the time. Or are they?
So, it's weird, because I think because they're used to the domestic life, they will sentry, they will stand up, because we've got vertical logs, horizontal or diagonal logs in there. We've added more recently. They will sit up. They do love the height. They do love to sit up high and look out. And when they don't think it's high enough, they would literally climb the door to the top of the door, the mesh, and then just look out the top. They're constantly communicating with each other. And I think that's one of the things, is you don't have that dynamic that a proper mob would have, where you have many, many individuals with each with their own, you know, the hierarchical system is a really interesting thing to watch, because they've changed positions in hierarchy two or three times.
Yeah.
Or at the start of when we first got them, it's almost like when we first got them, new environment, none of their scents, they've reestablished dominance.
Yeah.
And watching that was really interesting. It's weird, because it's not violent, but it looks it. You think they're like biting each other, but they're not. They're just rubbing scent on each other constantly.
Yeah, I've got a husky dog, and she's similar. So she like will play with her teeth out and makes horrendous noises. And if you didn't know, you'd think she was killing something, but that's just her playing.
Oh, yeah, I've got two that you'd come to my door and you'd think we run a dog fighting ring in here.
Yeah.
Because that's what it sounds like. So it's in a way a shame that there are only two. But they seem to do well, because I don't think they're as nervous. So in the start, when you'd feed them, they would eat, but they'd be constant, like they'd grab a mouthful really quickly, stare up at you, and then bolt back into their den. Now they'll sit there and just gobble, 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 and not stop. Only occasionally.
That's got to be nice as well, to know that they're comfortable enough with you around now as well. It's like a sense of accomplishment almost, isn't it?
Absolutely. Even with the, like I said, they were fine with the dogs from day one, but even with the dogs around, us around, doing whatever, the only thing they don't like is music. They really hate music, especially when it's bled through the Alexa. They're like, what is that outrageous sound? We're off. Other than that, they're fine with everything. Whenever we're in their proximity, they're at their door like, please, can you let me out, please? This didn't used to be a thing until recently, and now they just want to be out all the time, just running around next to us in the kitchen, etc. And where they're actually seeking to be let out is a really nice thing to see. They're seeking that sort of, you know, interaction rather than fleeing from it, which used to be the thing. We used to get them out all the time anyway. It would be a case of opening their door, completely retreating, and then letting them slowly over time come out and explore. And if you so much as moved an arm, they would just, all their little barking, and you'd think we have raptors, to be honest. The sounds these things make, I swear to you, me and Jay look at itself, sometimes they sound like birds, sometimes they sound like cats, sometimes it's like raptors. It's all sorts of noises they make. But there'll be the alarm call. You move your hand, the alarm call, and they're fast as well, straight back into their pen. Now, I literally have to shoo them, like scoot them out of the way with my feet to get past, and they just don't bother. To getting them back in their pen now, I was just clapping my hands. Come on, let's move, let's get in there. And they're just not afraid anymore, which even if we never get them to a stage where I can pick them up, I mean, don't get me wrong, they're looking at you. You just want to sort of scoot your hands under their arms and pick them up.
Well, they are cute, aren't they? You can't.
But even if I never get them to the stage where they are that kind of tame, what they are now is happy, in the sense of they're not stressed. They're not constantly, you know, nervous of threats. You know, you let them out and you sit there in a chair, and they'll climb up your leg onto your lap and take food out your hand happily.
Yeah.
They no longer see, and even with visitors, before it started getting better, it was me and Jay. If we were around, they were fine. Second a visitor comes in, forget it, you're not seeing them. But now, even with visitors, if the door goes, dogs bark,
they bark. they might scooch into their den for, you know, a minute or two, and then they'll come out to see who's here, whether a familiar face or not a familiar face.
Yeah.
Which is really nice to see. They're having that interaction and they're feeling more confident in themselves.
Yeah, most definitely. No, like I said, to see the change as well from them, like you say, hiding right at the beginning, being very wary when eating, to now almost wanting to be with you every minute of the day. That is just, like you say, there's no worry that they're not happy, which is brilliant. Obviously, you got two at the moment. Would you consider adding more so they have more of a mob mentality down the line, or are you happy with the two and just are sticking at that?
Meerkats are generally quite long-lived. That in mind, and the fact that they are mob creatures, and the fact that I just love the idea of baby meerkats, the plan is to, when we eventually move out, because we are looking to buy a house, and one of the main things are outdoor space. I really don't.
Yeah.
The interior is fine. Outdoor space is key. But the idea would be that we'd build quite a large, you know, massive outdoor enclosure.
Yeah.
Properly secured, properly, like, you know, if we want to give them 10 foot or 6 foot of depth of earth, we can do that, but then have a concrete base underneath it so they can't dig out. Because we were going to build them an outdoor pen here, but foxes terrify me, and I don't currently have the facilities to build something the way I'd want to build it to make sure nothing's ever getting in there.
Yeah.
If we can achieve that, an outdoor facility with them, you know, heated areas, etc., then I would look to potentially introduce a male to them.
Yeah.
It is always a risk. Meerkats don't accept outsiders easily, and they don't accept outsiders well at all.
Yeah.
So it would be a case that you would have to, you know, do we try and get a baby male meerkat and raise that up, like, by hand, so it's a bit more tame?
Yeah.
Do we try and I would prefer to rescue in these cases, but do we rescue an untamed, you know, potentially sub-adult adult male?
Yeah.
There's been a few people who've talked to me about how to do it, including, like, for example, giving both of them baths, potentially even separating them up for a short while.
Yeah.
And then introducing them into a neutral ground where no one's scent is on anyone.
Yeah.
Because we noticed when we washed them, they probably spent the next day and a half constantly scenting each other, scenting everything. So by wiping the scents clean, there may be the potential. It's a risk. It always will be a risk. And we know what the risk is. I would only do it under guidance of someone far more experienced than we are.
Yeah.
I would have to find someone who has successfully done this, who can walk me through the steps, because last thing we want is something going wrong and them attacking each other.
No, exactly. Yeah.
But if we could safely integrate a male and provide them with a massive outdoor facility, really, it wouldn't even be, well, an enclosure, but it would have to be facility, because you'd have to have, you know, a heated area, whether it be
an yeah, it's like a proper zoo spec enclosure. Exactly. Yeah.
If I could do that for them, then I would add a male and then never sell any. That would be the
honest. And are they all right, like, with the inbreeding and stuff? So say you go from your two females and you add a boy, eventually they're going to reproduce with each other. Is that all right bloodline-wise, or would you have to sort of...
I would assume, it being mammals, there would eventually come a time where problems would happen. Now, what would typically happen in the wild is... you rarely get new males introduced, but the females, once they become of age, will then, they're not in the wild, only the matriarch is allowed to breed.
Yeah.
The other females aren't allowed to breed. And therefore the other females would then disappear and start their own colonies elsewhere.
Yeah.
So, or they would stay behind and help nurse the young.
Right.
They, you know,
like surrogate mum sort of thing.
Exactly. Cause they will nurse each other's. So whilst the group is off on patrol or hunting, a female will stay behind to nurse the pups.
Okay.
Now, with only two girls and a boy, I would hope that we would not be overrun with meerkats. I would not be trying to make it a big scale thing, because I would prefer to never have to let any go, if that makes sense.
No, yeah, no, that makes complete sense. Because if they're already in rescues now, you don't want to be potentially adding to rescues later down the line because people are wanting to buy them and then realise they're a lot of work.
I really don't like the idea of selling meerkats. But, you know, there are plenty of rescues out there. There are plenty of zoological places out there that we could potentially negotiate with. Again, the problem with meerkats and the way their social networks work is a bit weird. In terms of, it's a bit difficult to just move meerkats around freely. Yeah. You can join that group, you can join that group. So I'd have to consider that as well, because that's a problem that could arise. You know, realistically, if I had a male here, am I actually going to cause problems for myself and for them down the road when they become overpopulated?
Yeah.
But the vision in my head would be to allow them to have a small group, essentially a small mob, as they call them.
Yep.
Just self-contained, you know, we'll look after them. I don't even know if you can neuter males.
You can neuter most things nowadays, but yeah. I know what you mean. So that sounds cool, to be fair. It sounds really like you've put a lot of thought into it already, and there'll be a lot more thought before anything does go ahead.
Yeah, it would be a number of years from now, and there would be a lot of discussion, thought, you know, logistics of everything, talking with experienced people before we make any commitment. I would prefer to just keep Janice and Mavis on their own, probably more connected to us where there are only two of them for the rest of their lives than have then potentially introduce problems by adding more of them.
Yeah. No,
it's their needs over my wants, if that makes sense. Yeah, I want to be able to talk about that and look at my little group of meerkats all run up for food. But at the same time, you know, let's say they live healthy lives and, you know, really strong mob. Eventually, all things do perish, including myself. What happens then? Where do these meerkats
end up? Yeah, well, exactly.
If I finally build this really good group of meerkats, you know, one day, if I get old and grey, if I even make it to that point, what happens to them then? And that's something else that always plays on my mind, because up until this stage, I have never given up an animal.
Yeah.
I've never rehoused an animal that I went out and brought home.
Yeah. It's something that, like, my wife and I have got tortoises, and it's a case of, they're not that old now, but obviously, when we eventually die, they're still going to be thriving, hopefully. So that's where do they go? And obviously they have to get written into will and all sorts and stuff. But that's a while down the road yet, so I try not to think about it.
Well, we have a Solcata. We have the Greek tortoise who currently lives between here and the school. And then we have four Redfoots. The tortoise thing is interesting. The Solcata is very interesting.
I love tortoises. If we had the space, I would love a Solcata, but there's no room for it, which is unfortunate, but maybe
we're looking at life. Her enclosure now is all right. We take her out in the summer. We put like paddocks outside for her to grow the grass, although there's no grass there this year, so I don't know what I'm going to do with that. But we always thought, you know, if push comes to shove, if we're still here, we haven't bought the house and built the enclosures, because every animal we have now, we have designed models and ideas of the ultimate enclosures that we want to build for them.
Yeah.
Including, for example, my Burma, I want a pond in there because she loves bloody swimming.
Yeah.
So we have our dream enclosures for our tortoises. However, if we were still here, then she would just have to free roam. I'd have to set up a basking area for her and just have her free roam the house, because they do get massive. And I know people...
Yeah, they do get huge.
There have been people who have successfully kept them outdoors in the UK.
Yeah.
You know, hot boxes and stuff like that. So that would be something I'd be looking forward or looking into down the road, potentially. Nothing beats natural sun.
Yeah.
No matter how great the UVB bulbs are, nothing will beat the natural sun. So, you know, a lot of our animals do get outdoor time during the summer. The Tegu, the Berms, because we put the pool out there in the summer, and before we put all the chlorine in and whatever, we fill up the pools and we just get in the pool with the Berms. And they swim around, exercise, we then drain the pool, refill the pool and put chlorine in. It's a waste of water, but it's enrichment for them.
And yeah, exactly.
I know they'd never seek to get out of it. Even if you let them go, they might perch on a corner to like support themselves for a while, but they never try to actually leave the water entirely.
Yeah, they're quite happy perched on the edge. Like they want to be near
with
it.
The rest of their body, with 90% of their body just in the water, either floating or submerged.
Yeah.
You know, the Tegu goes out there, although she goes completely ballistic when it's natural sunlight, but we let her out there on the hottest days and she just sits out there naturally basking.
Yeah.
Again, all of this under supervision, because if we lived in Florida, God help us all. Yeah, everything would be out there. But we live in the UK where it gets cold and it's nippy and it's damp.
Yeah, or the sun goes in, like it's 30 degrees and then the sun goes in and then it rains and it's like 12 degrees again. You're like, what happened there? Oh, that's awesome. So we're nearly there on my notes. There's still a few bits I want to cover. I want to just go over your the annual animal workshop at the school. So what is that for people that don't know? And how did you start doing that? And how's it going?
If we start with where I started doing that maybe 10 years ago, maybe a bit longer, with the ducks, actually. It was just the ducks at the time. I used to go to local primary schools and just do a little show every year with the ducks. I then became a teacher. And whilst training, every year we have Science Week, which is National Science Week. And during Science Week, the idea of it is to get kids excited about science, to, you know, reinvigorate the passion, et cetera, et cetera. And I just thought, can I bring my animals?
Yeah, too right. What sort of age group kids are you teaching?
I do secondary, so 11 to 16, well, 11 to 18, because the school I currently work with has a college.
Yeah.
Our sixth form. So typically, though, 11 to 16, although I've also done primary, I'm currently based in secondary. So there is once a year during Science Week, I take the animals out, which this for us was last Friday, not Friday, just gone the Friday before. And I just, depending on what the theme is, I create some sort of presentation and it's all, everything goes. I take the berms, I take the meerkats, I take the tegu, the tortoises. This year I took the chickens. I'll take frogs because I've got my classroom now. I had permission to run a club after school with some of the kids who have each decided on a particular species they want to work with. I mean, they're breeding red-tail boas successfully this year in the classroom.
Wow, that's amazing.
I've never bred a red-tail boa. I had to. One of the kids was really passionate about boas and snakes, so I said, well, I've got a pair we could potentially house in the school. They've done... Basically, I get them to do all the research. I act as, like, the overlooker, the overseer, the guider, if you will. But before they do anything, they do everything. They feed, they water, they clean, they pair them together, they unpair them together. I just show them how to do it, basically. So the female there at the moment is really far along. She's massive. So she's definitely gravid.
Yeah.
I don't know if she's close to yet. I've never bred a boa, so I have no idea. She's still eating, but she's humongous. So she might even get bigger before she goes. But there's frogs there, there's tarantulas, there's leopard gecko, there is... Yeah. About three different species of frogs, actually. There's blue-tongued skink. There's all sorts of stuff at the school, chameleon. So we take some of them animals down, and I run the event, essentially. The kids, we start off with a little presentation, depending on what the theme is. Get the animals out one by one. You can imagine what it's like when I bring out the female Burmese python. Everyone is like, oh, my God, whatever. Yeah. But then... After that, we get the kids to all get up and just go for it, touch, feel, interact.
Which is awesome, because there's not many opportunities, really, to do that. Even, like, going into pet shops, most of the time you can have a look, but you can't touch them. These kids, that's incredible.
We set up all the safety things, and, you know, you get groups of 15, 16 kids, because that's how many it takes in the line holding Burma.
Yeah.
And they do photo shoots with her, and even members of staff there, other teachers who, this year was two of them who had phobias, like snake phobias, and I had a couple of royals out because I was introducing them to the hobby, and the fact that the pet trade is a big thing and royals are currently a big thing out in terms of the reptile hobby, so they were looking at that, and this member of staff sort of saw these little snakes and was like, oh my god. I walked away and I said, one of them asked me if I could, how would they go about getting over a phobia, and I went, I'm not trained in phobias, but I can give you an experience you'll never forget as long as you trust me. And that, fair enough. And so I opened a massive trunk that held Burma in. I went, here you go. Pop her on your shoulders. And I think because she's so heavy, the mind is dealing so much with, oh my God, it's so heavy. I didn't expect it to be this heavy. I didn't expect it to be warm. I didn't expect it not to be slippery.
Yeah.
That before they know it, it's like, oh my God, I'm holding a snake. And I mean, I've got a member of staff there who is addicted to the damn tegu. She just goes in there, picks up the tegu like a child.
Yeah, yeah.
And the animals, because they've done this for so long and because we've socialized them here so long, I mean, I've said to them time and again, all these, you know, interactions, if you saw them in their enclosures at home, you would never touch them. Forget pick them up. When people see the feeding side of them, it's terrifying. I mean, dear God, I'm terrified of the tegu after time when she comes face her mouth open at the glass.
Yeah.
But with something as simple as tap training, even the tegu, a gentle little tap on her head and she's just immediately puppy.
Yeah.
A Burma last year, actually, when we did it last year, she was gravid and I had no idea that she was that far along.
Yeah.
So she was in deep blue to the point where the pictures are, she looks silver. She looks exanthic.
Okay.
They were handling her all day. She didn't so much as hiss once. And we brought her home and literally within 2 weeks, she dropped a clutch of 47 eggs.
Blimey.
So you think about when are you most likely to get bitten by a snake?
Yeah, exactly. Then, like, that's like
gravid.
Even looking at even like royals, I wouldn't, like, if I knew they're near laying, I'm not going in there if they're like.
If I'd known she was carrying eggs at that point, there would have been no way I'd have taken her.
But yeah, yeah.
We'd missed the ovulation. We'd paired them. We thought something might be going on. And to be honest, I didn't even notice at the show. She looked big, but she's always been big.
Yeah,
it wasn't.
She's a Burma. They're quite heavy-bodied snakes, and that it's hard to spot anyway.
After she shed, and then a few weeks later, I was just in the room and I realized she was under the heat and she was like almost. I panicked. I thought she was having some sort of like fit because she was just, her body was just tremoring all over. It then turns out she was literally getting ready to lay.
Yeah.
She started laying that night. I actually was there for the second or third egg. And I've watched, you know, Jay from Prehistoric Pets. I've watched him try and take clutches from retics. So I went in there ready, riot shield and all.
Yeah, like bin lid ready. Like,
was ready because I've been bitten by her once by accident and honestly not something I want to deal with, especially a mum on eggs.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, I took her eggs from her with her head literally resting in the palm of my hand. Yeah. I lifted her head. Her head was resting on one hand whilst I just removed the eggs with the other. She didn't hiss at me. She tried to buck when I tried to move her coils, but
yeah.
Other than that, not a hiss, not a strike, not anything. She's such an amazing animal.
Yeah.
And sharing that with kids, I mean, I enjoy teaching, but being a teacher isn't glamorous.
It's not at all.
Any teacher who loves their job in every aspect of it. There are moments of my job I love. There are moments of my job I would throw myself out of a window.
Yeah.
But I think most teachers would agree. I mean, at the moment, you know, doing these shows with the kids and seeing the passion and not only in the kids and the staff and other, you know, the buzz that remains for weeks after it, you know, just question after question, people coming to find
me. Oh, yeah, I bet. I bet there's quite a buzz before, like in a couple of weeks building up to it as well, because the kids are like, oh, the snakes are coming in, or all the lizards are coming.
We always make it a last minute sort of thing. The first year, they didn't know until the day. They had no idea what they were coming in the hall to see. They just came in and away we went. This year, they knew, but it's still, you know, even though a lot of them did it last year, it's amazing how interested kids are in chickens. I mean, honestly.
Yeah.
They were fascinated by the chickens. And
well, how often do you get to see a chicken that close up unless it's in Sainsbury's?
I mean, there are three chickens here, and about, 6 foot, 7 foot away, you had another pen with the meerkats set up on a stage. I mean, the meerkats got out. They slipped the bars because we decided to get them out, and suddenly now the meerkats were running all over the stage, and I'm panicking mid-presentation. I was like, what if they get and disappear? But it honestly is my passion. That the mixture of the animals and the education side, when they marry up in that way, is honestly the dream for me in particular. So much so that after this year's science event, we put in a, I have put in a proposition to the trust that we work for, in the hopes of servicing all 36 schools that we're a part of, basically, every year.
Oh, awesome.
So if I can push for that and just push out there. The misconception some of these animals, the misconception some of these kids and some of these adults have about some of these animals is incredible. That they even, I mean, to people like me and you who are in the hobby, we work with the animals, but to someone who's never really even thought about a snake twice, other than it's a venomous thing that lives in the jungle.
Yeah, or it will squeeze the life out of you and you'll die if you go near it.
It's such an invaluable thing because it's the public.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, it's, you know, these kids are all going home to their parents. And beside the point that it helps the hobby, because you're now having kids running home saying, mum, I want a snake, with their mum going, not in my house, you don't.
Yeah.
But you get, you educate them on what these animals actually are. And with that kind of outreach, I mean, there must have been, we must have presented to anywhere between 600 and 1,000 kids on that one day, including any of the kids who then come in during break and lunchtime. Not the countless number of adults who then come in. They're each going home having learned a lot about these animals, having touched them, picked them up, you know, poked them in some cases.
Yeah.
And I'm very much about get hands-on. Don't touch the meerkats because they'll bite you, but touch them. Get hands-on, experience it, feel what they feel like. You think it's slimy, well, touch it. Have a feel for yourself. There's nothing going on there. And honestly, if I could do this as a full-time thing down the road, that is the current goal. I love
breeding. Yeah, no, it is incredible. Like, that's to see it, like, to show that many kids, and I would say you've probably got 99.9% positive. There's probably that one kid that was terrified, but apart from that, like, they're all gone home, gone, oh my god, this is amazing, oh, I want one of these. And like, I've been interested in reptiles since I was, I don't know, probably 8 or 9. And I found growing up in school that there was nothing. Like, I didn't learn about it at all. If I wanted to know, I had to go on, like, read a book, watch Steve Irwin, or, like, go to a pet shop and hound the person to let me hold something. So for them to have that experience with you, bringing in such a variety of animals and obviously presenting to them, some of that's just, yeah, it's absolutely amazing. And fair play for giving all the kids that opportunity.
I mean, you get kids who are scared of snakes, but they're in my classroom, and they're never more than 10 feet away from the enclosure. And in the beginning, it's like, look, I'll put you on the other side of the classroom, I don't mind, but I'd like to try and work towards it. It can't get you. It's the other side of the glass. It's not the devil. It's not going to come out and get you. It's not interested in you, basically. And I teach with my animals. If I'm teaching biodiversity, or I'm teaching adaptations, I'll go and open the enclosure and pull out the boa. Or I'll go into another one and pull out, you know, a gecko or the skink or the chameleon, and teach them firsthand as we're working, as I'm teaching them, and their lessons they never forget.
Yeah.
I mean, I every year I teach genetics to kids, and I was taking royals. I do the intro to genetics. I've done a series on YouTube before, but I do that live in my classrooms.
Yeah, which it's awesome. Like, my daughter's, she's in year 7, and she's just started learning in science about, like, I think they're just sort of covering genetics a very little bit. So I've been teaching her, because she understands, if I tell her the royals, like, she understands the hets and whatnot. So she comes home with homework, and I'm like, right, here's a Punnett square with snakes in it. Like, it's the same, but it's just not snakes.
And we're talking kids who've never been exposed to Punnett squares, who I deal with a lot of kids in, sort of, you know, not very academically able. And everything else they may not do particularly well at, but they always ace genetics, because it's, I even have a game where I play, you know, guess Mr. Elbury's, guess Mr. Elbury's profits for the year. I give him random numbers, random snakes that don't particularly exist. It's just useful as an example.
Yeah.
I can take a normal and call it whatever the hell I want to call it, because the kids don't know any about.
Yeah.
And it's not about that. It's about creating this fun environment for them to really understand something that's not easy for most people to get.
Yeah.
You know, at GCSE, these kids are needing, they know probably more at GCSE than most of the reptile hobby knows. We know what a het is, but they will tell you, you know, you tell them het and they have no idea what the hell you're talking about. You say heterozygous, oh, now we're talking.
Yeah.
You know, there's like so many terms they need to know and apply. And I think it's giving them the opportunity to have a, you know, beyond pictures and videos and talking about butterflies that no one really cares about anymore.
Yeah.
Giving them, here's an animal, work it out. You know, there's just that experience. I mean, last year we took four of the Burmigs and incubated them in my classroom. And they were there for the pipping. They were there for the egg cutting. They got to see them crawl out the eggs. And that's not just the club, but because, you know, it doesn't happen instantaneously.
There's
however many days that I was teaching, all these kids are going up and having a look at these snakes hatching.
I bet you had kids knocking on the door at lunch and break, like, can we see the snakes hatching? Can we see the snakes hatching?
Every day, and I'm like, no, I'm eating bugger off. come at another point, and there's never the point to come. But the fact that they come shows the
interest. No, that's awesome.
So if I could do this full time, that would be my dream. I mean, if that was the case, if I am successful, because, you know, nothing is free in this world, and I have to think about, you know, myself and you know, the cost of keeping the animals, taking them in, potential vet bills from whatever reason. Insurance for me, which is something I never thought about before. But I could actually set this up as a business to service these schools, and then, you know, maybe one day service more than 36 schools in one trust, reach out to everywhere else. And I'm in a unique position. There are other companies out there who do it, but either the animals they bring are, I'll give you an example. The leading one in the UK is called Zoolab. The company that does these educational visits. What they bring is a corn snake, a leopard gecko, a tarantula, a scorpion, a stick insect, a cockroach, the hissing cockroaches, and an African land snail. They're the animals they bring. I might have missed one or two insects because it's mostly insects.
Yeah.
And they charge $6,000 a session.
Yeah, it's mad, isn't it?
It's like, what are they doing? They're not, oh yeah, they're DBS checked and whatever. None of them are teachers. None of them know how kids learn.
Yeah.
And I think I'm in a unique position where I do have the plethora of animals I have. I know my animals well enough. I have a background. Well, one of my degrees is in animal psychology and animal behavior.
Yeah.
So that's my passion when I'm working with these animals. And that's why sometimes the Royals don't really hit it for me.
Yeah.
Is they get the genetics side of me. I love genetics, and I was a geneticist long before I was a teacher. So I love playing with the genetic side of things, but it's the behavior, working with the peach throat monitor, who, again, is not an animal I'm ever going to sit there and cuddle, but that's not what I'm looking for.
Yeah,
I'm not looking for her to be puppy dog tame, as the term is.
Yeah,
I'm looking for her to express all her natural behaviors, all her natural instincts, whilst also feeling comfortable with me being in her presence.
Yeah,
that mutual respect of, I'm not trying to train you to do backflips. I'm not trying to train you to, you know, sit on my lap and let me stroke you. I'm trying to get you to a comfortable position where you are happy with me in your vicinity. You're not scared. You are acting like you would if I wasn't here. That, to me, is success. To me, that is enough. That level of trust is enough that I won't push it further. I don't need to push it further. I want animals to know I'm not a threat. I'm not a predator. I'm not going to do anything to you. I am a supplier of food, but I'm also not food. So please don't eat me. Please don't run from me, because I'm not trying to eat you. Let's just chill. Let's just have you, you know, do you, without being like, oh my God, who's that in the corner?
Yeah.
But if that happens, if, you know, that educational thing does take, you know, flight, and, you know, there is money to be made there, potentially, you know, a very decent livelihood, actually. I would downscale everything in some regards. I would downscale the Royals in particular. Don't get me wrong, I love the Royals, but the numbers we keep, I know there's people who don't like talking about the financial side of things.
Oh, it doesn't bother me.
But realistically, we don't keep, you know, 50, 60, 100 plus Royals for the giggles of it. We're doing it as a business. At the end of the day, we're all interested in making some sort of return.
Yeah.
And you know, we have plans for the Royals. You know, we've assembled the genetics necessary to potentially make a decent turnaround. But I would give that up in a heartbeat if I could do the educational stuff. I would still keep Royals. I would still play with Royals, you know, in terms of their genetics and breeding and trying to keep up with some of the madness going on out there.
Yeah.
That would be looking to, once again, do what MJ's Python does best and just expand variety-wise.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I've not worked much on is birds and mammals.
Yeah.
You know, been mostly reptiles, amphibians, that kind of stuff. But, you know, there's a whole different classification that we haven't even touched yet that that we
I know what you mean. Like I haven't got a lot compared to you guys, but I've got 17 royals, a few leopard geckos, cresties, tortoises, chameleon. But like you say, there's so many different animals that I don't want to turn my entire living room into just royals, because I want to be able to have dart frogs or like a monitor or this, that, and the other. And I think you gain so much more experience from having such a variety of animals that it helps the care of all the different types of animals that you have. Instead of just going, I've got royals, they live in a tub. Like, I go, oh, I've got royals, but they could benefit from something I've done over here with the cresties or...
Absolutely. Like,
yeah, so that's amazing.
Absolutely. The husbandry is crosses over constantly, because you might find success somewhere with a different species that you weren't expecting because of the different living requirements, because of the different enclosure, that suddenly give you ideas to prompt you to potentially better. I mean, I when we started, I was one of the most anti-tub people ever.
Yeah.
I had all my like 30-odd royals at the time, all in vivs, and I couldn't get these things to feed for love nor money. You know, it was sporadic. They bred in them. They fed in them sporadically. I have never seen them, you know, do as well as they do in tubs. And they're the only thing I keep in tubs.
Yeah.
You know, and the only reason I do is because experience and other people's experience have shown that actually it's the best for them. It's not great for us. Don't get me wrong. Yeah, they're very stylish racks and they're pretty and they're metallic and whatever. But they're not the nicest things to look at. They're, you know, I'm just opening tub after tub of lignocell and water and the occasional turtle.
Exactly. You go, there's a snake. That's nice. And the next one, like, you couldn't sit there and watch them.
No, whereas we've been here and this Bradley's python has been eyeing me up the entire time and just wondering why I'm in this room and why I haven't brought something, you know, a peace offering.
Yeah.
So the education side of things, I'll always keep royals. I'll always keep the animals I have now, potentially not on a big scale individually.
Yeah.
But a much larger scale in terms of diversity, you know, even if it becomes a small holding, you know, birds of prey have always really fascinated us. The large lizards that I would never be able to keep here, you know, a lot of the larger monitor species, and quite a few different mammal species. You know, there's so much out there that we've not even considered really yet.
Yeah.
That would be the future of MJs, whatever it gets called, because Pythons is a placeholder name.
Yeah, definitely.
It always was. That's what we did. And, you know, we did Instagram and YouTube and whatever. No point calling myself something else when all I ever really show at that time anyway was Pythons. But yeah.
No, that's cool. Something you've been teasing on your Instagram, and I don't know if you're going to go into any more detail or not, but I'm going to ask. You keep going, I've seen a couple of times now, you've mentioned the Ark, or I'm not sure how you pronounce it. Can we go into any detail of that, or is that a no, you're saying nothing until later in the year?
The Ark is a passion project. It's also an opportunity. I had someone ask me, is it an Azanthic red striped clown? It's not, I assure you. I wouldn't big up a reveal where we would be revealing another snake. I don't get me wrong, I love sneaking previews of snakes and stuff, but it's not an Azanthic red striped clown. It's something that has been a passion project for me now for a couple of years that I've been trying to do and achieve, but I've had to jump a lot of hurdles, and we finally have the opportunity to do it this year. It's also a way of us giving back to the community. A community that I had no idea existed until Jake from Python Junkie. There's his shout out, because he wanted a shout out, but there you go. But yeah, Jake pulled us out from obscurity, essentially, from the shadows, because we were very content breeding our royals and selling them on Gumtree. Little did I know there was an entire community out there that we were not a part of. But the community has, you know, encouraged us in so many ways. They've been so supportive. This is a way of us giving back. There will be a reveal shortly. I will sort of announce what's actually happening, and, you know, I've now leaked a date. But what I will say for now is that, as I said, it's a way of us, it will affect, or it should impact a number of people, quite a lot of people, hopefully. It is, and we will announce exactly what it is and what Ark is. We didn't want to call it MJ's Ark, because that kind of makes it our thing. This is an MJ's thing. So MJ's is organizing it, but what the arc stands for and what it means will be revealed, hopefully, within the next week. And the reason I said the next week is we are uploading, for the first time in a very long damn time, a new YouTube video on an egg cutting, which was a clutch that we were not even expecting, that just one of the girls was like, here you go, here's 4 eggs. And it just worked out as a perfect timing for us. Now that everything has been 100% confirmed, at the end of that egg cutting video, we'll then announce it, and then we'll make a big announcement on Facebook, etc., on YouTube, Facebook, that kind of stuff. But it's something to look forward to.
Yes, something it sounds very exciting. I'll be watching it very closely, because I was trying to work out what it could be, and I don't know. So
the arc has so many. The actual name itself, arc, although it's not related here. Many years ago, I was going to open a pet shop. And the arc was part of its name back then. It was going to be, you know, the ducks were my main thing at the moment at that time. So I was going to name it after them, and the arc was going to be involved in the name, etc. So when we came up, when we were thinking of a name for this whole thing, it does stand for something, but the arc was something that was close to me from the past.
Yeah.
So I had to make it work. I had to sort of fit the words in. Will it work? Will it not? You know, could we call it the arc? What could the arc stand for? Because, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I will say, keep your eyes peeled. More announcements will come soon.
Awesome.
I'm very, very excited about it. And I hope it's the start of a whole new thing again.
It sounds really exciting. Right. So we're going to start to wrap up, as much as I could sit here and go on for another hour at least. My belly's rumbling. I'm quite hungry.
and so, if you don't end it now, I am known for going on for 4+ hours.
It's fine. So I've got a few little bits to wrap up, and then we will call it a day. So you have already given a shout out, but is there anybody that you wanted to, particularly friends or inspiration in the hobby or not necessarily in the hobby, that you wanted to give a shout out to?
The community as a whole is in its entirety for every positive thing that has come from it, and every negative thing. Because every negative thing has been food for thought and progress. Yep. Individual shout out, obviously I gave Jake a shout out. Jake is, although many people think Jake is part of MJ, he's another J.
There's he's two a different Jakes. J.
It's MJ, and then there's Jake Python Junkie. And he has been we called him the boss for the longest time, or the manager, because he was the one who got us out there. He's the one who pushed us to go onto YouTube, onto Instagram, to reach out to the community, and the response has been phenomenal, and I still can't believe it. So him as just, you know, a constant, also a constant grounder.
Yeah.
That man loves to ground me every time I'm high, which might sound a bad thing, but he keeps my head out of the clouds, which is a really good thing.
No, it is good to, definitely.
In terms of inspiration, especially in current circumstances, obviously, Brian Barczyk. I mean, to say the news is devastating, to say watching the last few videos has been...
It's been heartbreaking.
Extremely difficult. Literally, it's like one of the hardest things I've had to watch for a while. Just because of how sudden, just because of how severe, just because of just how, like, you don't... It sobers you up quite a bit. I mean, at least
me. It really does. Video. It makes me think, like, my wife and I have been sat watching his videos for the last, I don't know, we've been together nearly 10 years. And the last 2 weeks, I don't think either of us have cried watching a YouTube video as much as we have in the last few days.
Yeah, it was.
And it's just horrendous.
It is horrendous. Sobering as well, because who would have thought?
Yeah.
And I'm certain he would have, and he's expressed that, you know, a few weeks ago everything was fine, and to suddenly get this kind of news is it's so no one knows who's next, no one knows what could happen tomorrow. So if anything that has brought back to the forefront of my mind, it's today is the only thing that matters.
Yeah,
and it's always good to look to tomorrow, it's always good to have ambition, but you know, don't always live into tomorrow, don't always look, well, appreciate the time we have now.
Yeah, appreciate what you've got going, as well as having goals. It's good to just take a step back and go, actually, I'm doing all right at the moment.
We are hoping to use the arc as well to support Brian in hopefully a really good way. I mean, in as much of a capacity as we can.
Yeah.
You know, we all wish we could do more. I'm personally, as MJs, we're going to try and really put something together to try and help with, you know, his dream of essentially the legacy.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, it's called the Legacy Aquarium. His legacy will never go, and it's hard to talk about it, really, because for so many of us, I know there's people who love Brian, people who detest Brian, and regardless of your opinion on him as a person, he is responsible for so much of this hobby, for the actual
existence. Yeah, no, I completely agree.
We're not talking about, you know, the latest Royal and you know, the new gene here and there, but the passion, the enthusiasm. And I relate to him some. I mean, he's done it through YouTube and through building the Reptarium, and I'd love nothing more than one day to build something like that, which is an ultimate goal, is to build some sort of educational area where people can have that experience here in the UK. But his passion is what pushed so many of us forward, in particular us. I would have never tried to breed royals. I would have never tried to do any of this if it weren't for the inspiration I got from him.
Yeah, I completely agree.
There have been so many other people who have affected us, and there's so many people. I mean, we can think of everyone. But, and especially in these times, you know, our thoughts and prayers are with him. And,
most definitely.
He said about hoping for a miracle, and I damn well hope so.
I think everyone is hoping for a miracle. I think Brian is probably, he's like this, what's the word? This generation's like Steve Irwin. And it's horrible to say, because Steve Irwin's like the same, like should be the same age, but he was obviously taken so early. And I think we're all praying the same thing doesn't happen to Brian. He doesn't go down that same path. Him as well, but his whole family and his crew.
Yeah,
like, it's devastating for all of them.
I can only imagine what they are all going through at the moment. I can only imagine because I can't imagine it. I mean,
it's unfathomable.
It's just heartbreaking, honestly.
It really is. So the thoughts and prayers for Brian from all of us over here as well. Right, let's finish off, and then we can go and have some dinner and whatnot and have a nice end to the evening on Saturday. So I'd like to finish off the podcast with something I call the Hall of Shame and the Hall of Fame. You have to use your entire imagination. So basically, the Hall of Shame and the Hall of Fame, they're two halls for beginner exotic animal keepers or reptile keepers, however you want to say. So they have to walk through the Hall of Shame first, and in the Hall of Shame are pedestals where every single guest has put something on in the Hall of Shame that is a bit like Room 101. So, oh, I was given that bit of advice, or I've used this, it's crap, no one I should ever use it, it's there. And then once they've gone through the Hall of Shame, they're into the Hall of Fame, which is all the good bits. And we like to finish on a good bit. So, what would you put in the Hall of Shame? Last week, last podcast, Paul Burrows from Paul's Monsters added red bulbs. So what is your item for the Hall of Shame?
Item?
It doesn't have to be an item. It can be advice.
Okay. Just so I'm clear before I start wrapping up.
Go on.
Advice to disregard or advice to give?
Disregard in the Hall of Shame.
This is an interesting question. Oh my lord, you've stumped me.
So I'll give you some examples of what we had. So Paul's put in red bulbs. I suggested the heat rocks. We've had someone suggest a specific type of water bowl that they had no luck with. And then we had somebody that said, don't think you know everything. Or so it was a sort of like a backwards way of saying, listen to what other people have to say. But
I definitely put that you'll never be the best at anything because we always have room for improvement. Yeah. So in that vein, listen to everyone. Don't take everyone's advice.
Yeah. But listen to it.
Yeah. Don't be deaf to advice.
Yeah. Cool. And the Hall of Fame. So something that you would recommend everybody either goes and gets or uses or listens to. What is your Hall of Fame item?
My Hall of Fame. Just because of my background, just because it's going to be really cliche and cheesy.
That's right. We like cheesy.
Education.
Yep.
You don't need a piece of paper to be educated. You don't need a certificate to be educated. And you don't need to go on a course to be educated. education comes from everyone and everywhere. And don't always think that the people you see, quote unquote, at the top are the only source of information out there. Everyone, starter, someone who's been experienced, someone who's been doing this their entire lives, everyone can teach you something. So the one thing I would say for everyone, it doesn't matter what species you keep, it doesn't matter what you know, part of the hobby you're in, whether you're into breeding or keeping, just educate yourself as much as possible. Only you and the animals can benefit from it. So that would be my...
I think that's a cracking piece of advice to add to the Hall of Fame, to be quite honest. Thank you very much. So that is the end of the podcast. All you got to do now is plug yourself, so to speak. So Instagram, Morph Market, YouTube, Facebook, anything. Where can people find you?
MJ's Pythons basically everywhere. So MJ's Pythons on YouTube, MJ's Pythons on Insta, MJ's Pythons on Facebook. Morph Market will be under MJ's Pythons. TikTok is under MJ's Pythons, although I haven't really started playing with it so much yet, but it has all been very quiet for a while. So apologies for everyone who has already followed us, who's thinking, where the hell have they gone? We will be back. There are exciting announcements, as we talked about. Many things are happening. We will keep you updated. I'm hoping to be back on my feet in its fullest very, very shortly, like from now, hopefully.
This is the start.
This is the start. Thank you so much for having me on, by the way.
You're very welcome. I've really enjoyed our conversation. I'm just going to kick you out now and finish off the rest of the podcast. But thank you very much. Really enjoyed chatting to you, man. And I will sure catch up with you guys soon.
Absolutely. Take care, bud.
Nice one. Cheers. Thank... Oh. Right. So there we go. Thanks for listening to that. That was almost 2 hours. And I enjoyed every single second of it. Like I said at the beginning, if you want to keep up to date with what's going on, you can check me out at Ben's Balls is my like snake or reptile Instagram. And at RepsChat is the podcast official Instagram account. Go over there and give us a follow if you want to keep up to date with guests and whatnot on the podcast. And like Q&As and things like that, they'll be on the Instagram stories before they go onto the podcast. If you want to support the podcast, there are some links below, so you can give us a follow, give us a like, comment, subscribe, follow, all that sort of stuff. There's also a link to Buy Me a Coffee, so if you wanted to donate towards the upkeep and running of the podcast, it would be much appreciated, and it's a cost of a coffee down there. Companies and anybody else listening, if you want to, there are sponsorship opportunities available, so feel free to slip into my DMs. But apart from that, we will see you or hear you in your ear holes in the next 2 weeks. So yeah, that's me. Thank you very much, and till next time. Bye bye.